This is an ABC podcast.
History tells us a story. In fact, various stories about where we came from, what happened along the way, and who we've become, our national identity. But history is the product of the cultural values and beliefs of the time in which it was written. So who and what then gets left out of history? Who is shaping these shifting narratives? And why has much of our history excluded and silenced First Nations Australians? I'm Paul Barclay, and this Big Ideas looks at the making of Australian history. Can history ever be objective? The past is never dead. It's not even past. So wrote American author William Faulkner, and this can certainly be said of Australian history. This conversation was recorded at the Byron Writers Festival and features Anna Clark, historian at the University of Technology, Sydney, and author of Making Australian History. Fiona Foley, an artist from the Wandunna clan of the Batchelor Nation and author of Biting the Clouds. And Mark McKenna, leading historian and author of several books. His latest is Return to Uluru. So, Anna, your book's a history of history, really, a history of how our history has been shaped and told. Some people might think that history is just simply an outcome of going through the empirical, archival, you know, resources that are available to us, objective presentation of facts marshalled into a story. What do you conclude, though, about the factors that have shaped how our history has been told?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something I often discuss with my students, and when I talk to them about history, what is history? I say to them, you know, the past is what happened. You can't change the past. It's in the past. But history is a doing word. It's a process. It's an act of interpretation. And that's why people disagree about the past, and that's why it changes over time. So the ways we read the past or don't read the past, that is what history is about. History can be an act of inclusion, of telling people's stories, but it can also be an act of silencing and relegation. It's really a curation. And how that curation changes over time is the story of history, the curation of the past.
So when did the making and the telling of Australian history begin? And if the answer to that question is that it began before the arrival of Europeans who wrote it down, how do you approach the telling of that history?
That was actually the first kind of question I asked myself when I started the process of writing this book. You know, if you think of, I wanted to tell the story of Australian history, the story of that curation. Where do you begin? Because in fact, the beginning point of Australian history has changed over the decades. If you were writing a history of Australian history in the 1890s, the beginning point is colonisation, that history arrived with the colonists. But of course we know, thanks to the generous sharing of histories by First Nations peoples, that history has been made and produced in Australia for thousands of years. So I suppose the question then is, as historians who have, you know, overwhelmingly been trained in a university system and in a school system, how can our training allow for the incorporation and the understanding of other forms of history telling and historical production?
Yeah. Fiona, your book addresses history that many of us are not aware of, actually, and as such, it's a critique of history, of what's told, what's not told, what's authorised. I thought I'd start by asking you, how harmful has the telling of Australian history and the erasure of critical stories from our past been to First Nations people?
First of all, I'd just like to acknowledge the Bundjalung Nation, whose land I'm speaking on today. It's been one of those burning questions since I was a child, looking out across Tagari at Yerangan Beach, from Yerangan Beach, wanting to know why there were no Batchelor people living on our traditional lands and the largest sand island in the world. And there was really no satisfactory answer to that question. And as you get older, you start to piece together the jigsaw puzzle a little bit more. And history has been written by the victors in this country. And my emphasis as I started my profession in the visual arts was always to underwrite pretty much every public art commission that I won by writing back an aspect of history or an Indigenous nation or an Indigenous individual so that they were remembered in the visual landscape. And that's been now an art practice of 35 years. Biting the clouds is also uncovering other types of history. One of those is the legislation, the Aboriginals Protection and Restriction of the Sale of Opium Act. And my curiosity wanted to investigate why the words Aboriginal and opium were in the same title. Now, that's a complex history involving three races in Queensland, Europeans, Chinese and Aboriginals. And each one of those races were partaking in the use of opium and importation licensing by the state government, and also the addiction of Aboriginal labour through giving Aboriginal employees opium ash as a form of payment. Most Queenslanders are unaware of that history, even though the licences were widely distributed in the state of Queensland. This is a history that no one talks about anymore. It was also a way for government to get into Aboriginal communities and start removal of Aboriginal men, women and children to relocate them in other parts of the state. So that's an aspect of a hidden history that populates the book through that piece of legislation.
Yeah, and it's a history we'll come back and talk a little bit more about as well. Mark, I think that Fiona's art practice, as well as her book, addresses this notion of the silences in our history. Yeah. Biting the clouds is really a corrective, a story that we haven't been told in the past, and to me at least, a bit of overdue truth-telling as well. Mm. Is history, and should history be about truth-telling? Should it be about rectifying something from the past that the historian thinks needs to be corrected? Is that an acceptable starting point?
It's certainly, Paul, hello everyone, it's certainly an acceptable starting point now in the moment that we're living in. I think there's a huge call for truth-telling across our culture, not just in the writing of history, but across the culture. And I think one of the key things, and I'm sure Anna would have seen this, has seen it in her own work, is who is speaking when we write history? Whose voices are given authority? And one of the things that we've tried to do, historians, I think more recently, certainly in my own work, is to make sure that I'm not writing about people, but also giving their voices prominence, letting their voices explain their experience. And rather than the historian being the figure of authority. And I think in terms of truth-telling, that is one way that we go about truth-telling, in that we must allow Indigenous voices and all of the voices who've been silenced and marginalised to speak about their historical experience. I mean, as for the objectivity of history, it's the subjectivity of history that gives it life,
yep,
that makes it accessible, that makes it readable.
Well, these were all the questions that flowed from reading Anna's book for me. Mm. Questions like, what role should emotion and sentiment play in history? Should historians distance themselves from what it is that they're studying? And I was saying to Anna, these are questions that we as journalists confront as well. What is objectivity and fairness? Do we need some distance from a story? If we get too close to that story, does it distort how we tell it? Does it mean we're not looking at other perspectives? So I suppose my question is, should historians abandon entirely the idea of empirical objectivity? Either one of you can have a crack at that.
You go first if you like. I'll say something after.
Sure. Okay. Should we abandon the idea of distance? Certainly not in the sense that the past, as one of our most famous historians, Greg Denning, said, is not us dressed up in fancy clothes. It's another country. It's a different place. And so you need that distance. But when you think about the ways in which historians as writers try and create that distance, they tell themselves, I should not write in the first person. I should keep my own presence somehow invisible. And in my own work, I think it's important that historians use the first person where warranted, because it's us, we are the ones who are writing. So we have to abandon that pretense that somehow there's an author out there who's not us, who's on the page. And we can't separate our emotions and feelings from a lot of the material that we're dealing with. It's impossible to write, for example, about the Australian frontier and not feel like physically sick sometimes at the evidence that you're confronting. I mean, I've felt that myself many times. Anna?
Oh, I was going to say, one of the things I really enjoyed about Fiona's book, Biting the Clouds, is that it really highlights the problem of writing history in the name of truth. I think non-Indigenous historians have controlled what is objective, what is scientific history, what are the facts, what is the truth for a really long time, and it actually showed how coloured and how selective that truth has been. And so I think we need to be careful about using those words as an overarching sense that we can somehow curate and order the past according to a truth, because those very words have been used for a long time and only told part of the story.
I'll come back to Fiona in just a sec, but just on that, also the imperatives of the notion of nation building being built in to how we tell our story, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of the really interesting things I came across as I was researching this book, was just how closely linked this idea of the national story has been to the history profession, professional history. And that's not the sort of history that's kept alive in families, for example, necessarily, or in creative practice or in historical fiction. It's the official history discipline that's taught in schools, that's set in syllabuses, that's, you know, historians are trained under. And in the 19th century, this sort of historical practice became increasingly professionalised, and you know, degrees were established, history professors were appointed, history syllabuses were written for the first time, history textbooks were published for the first time. And that process of professionalisation happened at the same time as nations became increasingly sanctified, if you like, and the idea of the Australian nation emerged, and that we had an Australian identity, a national identity. And this, in order to make the Australian nation legitimate, it needed a narrative to show that it was legitimate and that it was a story of so-called progress. Mm. And I think there's a really interesting relationship between historians as national storytellers, and that, you know, in a sense, that relationship, that the sort of power you get from being a national storyteller legitimates your profession, and the power the nation gets from having a national story legitimates the nation.
Yep.
And they became increasingly dependent. What's interesting is what happens outside that conversation, and whose stories, therefore, are not being told in that kind of national story of
progress.
Because
they're inconvenient stories.
Yeah, and
they disrupt
the nation.
The brutality of the Australian frontier.
Right.
Convicts, they don't really wrap around a friendly story about Australia.
Or they do at different times. You know, for a long time, convicts, you're not allowed to include that in the national story because it's uncomfortable.
Yeah,
but now you can.
Yeah.
And, for example, the story of the Stolen Generations is not included in the national story for a very long time. And then at some point, there's a sort of a receptiveness to it. And it would be very hard for me, as somebody involved in history education, for that to not be in a national curriculum, for example. These things, I think, change over time. But the idea of who we are as Australians, Australia's own history, can be seen by reading its historians and its written histories over the years.
So Fiona, we've got two professional historians and an artist who tells history through art. It would be one of my ways of describing your art practice. Can you tell us how you see your role as an artist telling us about our history, and perhaps how that fed in to your book, which features your art as well as the story that you've mentioned about Fraser Island? You probably hate this question about your art practice, don't you?
Little bit. it's hard to know really how I sort of came into speaking truth to power, really. And I think it's in my nature to stand up and say, hey, hang on a minute, there needs to be more accountability in this space. And so I've been a provocative artist thinker for a long, long time, and writing a book about various things is really no different to me making an artwork outside of Brisbane Magistrates Court called Witnessing to Silence, where I had to maintain a period of, for 2 years, a period of silence and not tell the authorities what that particular public art commission was about. And I had a researcher work secretly on the side with me to unearth on the public record all of the massacre sites she could find on the public record in the state of Queensland. And I thought the list would be somewhere around about 100. I'm not saying it's the definitive list, but she did come up with 94 massacre sites, and we engraved that into the pavement outside of Brisbane Magistrates Court. And I knew that this was an opportunity that I had to call into account outside of the law courts, one of the first injustices that has never been acknowledged in this country. And it's a continuation of calling people out and saying, you need to address this. You need to address the land theft, the murders, the massacres that have taken place in this country. And we need to have these very serious discussions in this country. And you can only do that so much with a public artwork. And I think through writing Biting the Clouds, which was a PhD for Griffith University, that I'm reaching a broader audience because I don't have to give as many talks because people can buy the book and read it.
Let's for just a moment there talk about Griffith University, named after Samuel Griffith, Premier of Queensland, first Australian High Court judge, eminent jurist, eminent Australian, Griffith Review, named after him. Also a Premier who sat around the cabinet table at the time that the native police in Queensland were brutally suppressing and killing Aboriginal people and did virtually nothing about it. How much should we hold him responsible, and how much truth-telling needs to be told about Samuel Griffith? And is it time now for the institutions that are named after him to address these questions?
Excellent question. So last year I read Henry Reynolds' Truth Telling, and in his chapters 11, 12 and 13, he puts out a direct provocation to Griffith University to think about renaming the university after someone else because of the role that Sir Samuel Griffith played as the Premier twice and allowed the massacres with the Native Mounted Police in the north of the state to continue. During both those terms, he was the Premier of the state. So I got wind of this through reading Henry's publication, and I organised a symposium in June this year. And fortunately for me, there was also a large article that was written about by a journalist in The Guardian who profiled the complexity of this history. And I think it's something that Griffith University need to be on the front foot about. And in 2025, it will be the 50th anniversary of Griffith University. And I think Griffith University, the upper echelons of the executive, need to state a position. Which way are they going to go? Will they consider renaming the university, or will we stay with Griffith University and have to address the complexity of the man and the deeds that he allowed happen in the state?
Yep.
universities overseas, some prominent universities are starting to address some skeletons in their past along similar lines. Mark, Anna, do you have any thoughts about what Fiona just said?
Thanks, Fiona. I mean, I think having worked in a major university over the last few decades, we all know that protocols around the recognition of Indigenous culture and history, the universities today make a big deal of doing that. They like to signal that they're attentive to those things. Well, if you don't change the name of Griffith University, to me it makes a mockery of all of those protocols that they claim to adhere to.
Yeah, I guess I would just add that for those of us who are in institutions and historians in institutions, it really highlights that the university system and my own profession as historians have been complicit in the stories that have been told and the the sort of hierarchy of whose stories and who's allowed to tell them. And it's time to, think about our own professional legacies and the sort of complicitness of our own professions in what stories that have been told in Australia and how that needs to change.
I mean, are these conversations that are going on among historians at the moment?
I think so, absolutely.
Questioning the discipline itself.
Questioning the discipline itself. Definitely. And, one of the things I'd be interested to see what Fiona and Mark have to say about this is, as a historian who has been trained in empirical history but is also increasingly interested in other forms of history telling and history making that aren't necessarily, from the written archive in a state library, if you like, is history capacious enough to take on these different forms of knowledge sharing, or is our practice too colonial, too bound up in the sort of Enlightenment project, if you like? Can it never change? Does the whole thing have to be torn down, or can history be sort of nuanced and complex and generous and flexible enough to take on new forms of understanding, which are difficult perhaps? You've been trained in empirical history and an archive is a piece of paper with a signature on it and you know it came from 1895, and you're comparing that with, say, a rock engraving of contact, which might, you could argue is also a really important source of what happened in Australia, but it doesn't have an author perhaps, and it certainly doesn't have a date neatly engraved next to it. But the cost of not including that in our story of Australia is far greater. So there's a real challenge there for history and historians to take on these different knowledges and different ways of understanding and different ways of telling Australia's story. And I'm interested to see what happens to those of us who've been trained in the discipline and whether we are able to actually do this in a way which is sensitive and engaging.
Because, Mark, anthropology is facing similar questions, and criminology facing similar questions.
Archaeology.
Particularly as it pertains to First Nation people.
I mean, I think, one of the big things that's happened in the last two decades is that the whole concept of history and the writing of history, the way we speak about history, has been democratised, which is a great thing. In other words, the old sense of gatekeeping, the old ideas of empirical history, I think have been blown out of the water. And if you only need to look at the number of history books that have changed people's understandings of Australia in the last 20 years. There are many of them. So the writing of history at the moment, I think it's one of the most exciting times to be a historian, because our archival base is endless. It has no boundaries. We should draw on rock art, of course. We should draw on other voices, every possible source we can draw on. And yes, I mean, one of the great things, the challenges of writing nonfiction, is its creativity. It's the creative dimension to nonfiction and incorporating those nuances, incorporating that imagination and bringing it across to the reader, bringing your own excitement about the past across to the reader.
The difficulty, Fiona, is that when so much of your history has been erased, and when you seek to retell the history of your people as you have, and they've been written out of history, how do you begin to piece that history back together again and tell some truth?
I had a great example in my mother, Shirley Foley, who would go to state libraries and track down articles of black and white photographs or the South Australian Museum and find cultural objects that belong to the Batchelor people. And so it was just the start of a jigsaw puzzle. And then she'd say, and both my parents loved reading books, and then she'd say something like, have you read Rosalind Kidd's book, The Way We Civilize? Mm. And so I grew up in a family of readers, and so I started that journey in my early 20s when I read a publication by C.D. Rowley called The Destruction of Aboriginal Society, and there was one chapter on Queensland, and I was about 1984, I was in my early 20s, and it was the first factual account, and I could understand this history about race politics in the state of Queensland that was an accurate historical account. And then the following year, Henry Reynolds published The Other Side of the Frontier, so I had another publication I could turn to. So, unbeknownst to a lot of people, I would buy these publications and read them and digest this information and use that information to create artworks. For instance, like a sculpture that just uses one word called dispersed. Mm. That's has been on permanent exhibit at the National Gallery of Australia. So it allows me a platform to talk about this history, but I have relied heavily on published historians. Mm.
I was very struck in your book, Fiona, about the way you described your mum. It was very moving, actually. And to me, she's the sort of epitome of a really vital historian in that story, actually. And she might not have the label of a capital H historian, but that's exactly what she's doing.
Mm. Yeah, thank you.
Actually, can I just ask, going back to your previous answer about the installation in front of the law courts in Queensland that you kept hidden from the authorities, what was the response when it finally presented itself? Because the context of that artwork, exactly where it is, around that legal precinct, with all of the kind of heaviness of white law, is so potent. What did the authorities have to say?
Well, the way that I strategically laid it out publicly was through an article in The Australian, where the journalist Miriam Kozak contacted the Premier of the state at the time, Anna Bligh, who was also the Minister for the Arts, and asked her for her response to Fiona Foley's artwork. And Anna was on the front foot and said, oh, we wish Fiona could have said that this was, you know, what she was doing with her artwork, and, you know, we really like her work. And I'd known from previous experience, if I had have divulged the information, I would have been very quickly shown the door and the commission wouldn't have been forthcoming. So I had already tested the waters, so I knew this time I had to be completely quiet about what the list entailed. So I made up a fabrication and said the list of place names were where fires and floods had taken place, and unbeknownst to the fabricators, I'd switched the list with the massacre list to the fire and flood list, which was a bodgy list to start with. And so I had to be cunning.
You had a fake history somewhere else, which is the fire and flood list that's in
but
some...
But the judging panel were already cautious about, you know, one of the statements they said to me, we don't want her to bring doom and gloom to the courts where fire and floods had happened. And I thought, oh, how conservative, you know.
When we think of history, Anna, as I said before, we think of primary documents sifting through the archives, in Mark's case, which we'll come to in a minute, going through some old documents in a garage in a suburb. You, though, talk in your book about other sources, oral history, cave paintings, artwork, which is obviously part of Fiona's history telling, non-professional histories as well. Tell us about the place that those less conventional sources now play in the telling of our history, in the telling of a perhaps more complete history.
Yeah, I suppose it's partly an an interest and a commitment to telling a more complete history. And it goes back to that earlier question you had about, you know, how removed should we meet, you know, what's the motivation for doing history? And for me, it feels like an ethical obligation to, you know, as a historian, think about all of the sources that are out there and what do they tell us about our past. And sometimes they're, you know, not necessarily verifiable, but as I mentioned before, the cost of not including them, I think, is far greater than the challenge that they might present in their inclusion. One of the examples I would give is that over the course of the 20th century, Australian history has sort of been policed, if you like, by historians about what is and isn't, you know, real history, or what isn't a proper source. And when W.H. Stanner gave his famous lecture in 1968 about the silence of history, the Great Australian Silence, someone actually wrote to him afterwards, a guy called Ian Mudie, and said, you know, historians have been silent about Aboriginal history, but there are others in our community who have been very interested in this story. And he mentioned creative writers, and you might think of, you know, poet Judith Wright, the author Eleanor Dark, but you could also add on to that the 1938 Day of Mourning, which is a protest. But that's a form of history telling, I think. And so there's a point, I think, where historians like myself have to have a reckoning, if you like, about what do we include in the sort of corpus of Australian history making. It's not really necessarily a narrative that you might want to tell, a chronological narrative. In a sense, it might be more like a map. And the limits of what is and isn't in that map of Australian history changes over time. The borders change, and sometimes they're even porous in the relationship between history and fiction, for example. But I feel like there's a really strong ethical demand there to think about history, to think about that map of history in an expansive and critical way.
I mean, how important is it for a nation to have a heroic narrative, to have a narrative that we can feel proud of as a people? I mean, we've heard these kind of conversations. You know, history is contested. We've lived through an era where we've seen that. But so much of our history is appallingly brutal and violent and has sidelined the original peoples of this nation. Do we just have to sit uncomfortably with that history rather than delude ourselves that ours is a history of, you know, triumph?
Well, it'd certainly be easier in a way if it was a history of triumph. It'd certainly be more convenient.
Boring.
I mean, I don't want to be flippant here because it's really serious, but I mean, I think a lot of the debates around the culture wars and the history wars isn't just a political debate between left and right. It's actually a debate about what is the purpose of history. And for some history, absolutely, the purpose is absolutely to bolster the nation. Look at syllabuses in China, for example, and even to a degree in other nations like
United
Japan.
United States.
And there are others who believe that the purpose of history is to develop critical thinking and a sort of citizenship which is can deal with difference and differences of opinion. And that's where I stand. It's more of a disciplinary interpretation of history. Pardon the sort of the jargon, but it's a sense where history, its very difficultness, enables us to have a more complete and complex understanding of ourselves and where we've come from.
Mark, you began writing a history of Central Australia in Uluru. You ended up, though, revisiting the story of a killing of an Aboriginal man in Uluru in 1934 by a Northern Territory police officer, Bill McKinnon.
Yeah.
This is a micro story that tells a much bigger story of frontier violence in Australia. Bill McKinnon was a white lawman and he shot and killed an Aboriginal man. Yokanunna,
yes.
Tell us a bit about what interested you about that story and how you ended up telling it. And you could probably talk for the rest of this session about that.
But I won't. So just in a nutshell, my latest book, Return to Uluru, tells the story, as Paul said, of the shooting of an Aboriginal man at Uluru in 1934. He was chased along with five other men, Aboriginal men, who'd escaped Bill McKinnon's custody, and he cornered one of those men, Yokanunna, in a cave at Uluru and claimed to a Commonwealth Board of Inquiry 8 months later that he fired into the cave at this man who was defenceless without taking aim. And the Commonwealth Board of Inquiry into the shooting found they exonerated Bill McKinnon. So this was going to be part of my broader history of Central Australia, but it actually hijacked the whole book. And the book itself is about the shooting and its aftermath and the telling of the history of that event in Indigenous oral history and also in settler history. In a way, I think one of the big things I learned was how those two histories were travelling on parallel tracks, but they never kind of really met. And the book is an attempt, I guess, to bring those histories together. And it also taught me a lot about writing history because, as Paul intimated, I found myself in a Brisbane garage in the daughter of Bill McKinnon's home. So she was then in her early 80s, not far from us here in Logan. And she was very kind. She said, "I've got some things of my father's in the garage that you're welcome to look through." And there in the garage were the legacies of Australia's frontier. And this is something that's really quite, I think, you know, telling for the moment we're in now, that you can still find in a suburban garage the very brutal documentation of the taking of Indigenous land and the brutality of that conquest in Central Australia, which wasn't that long ago. I'm writing about a period when Don Bradman, for example, was scoring his centuries. But this story doesn't make the citizenship test in a way that one, how many runs Bradman scored. So it's brought home to me how close, how proximate this frontier history is, and the connection between that past and the present in which we live. This history is still present. Its legacies, its consequences are continuing to unfold. I never forget being told at Uluru, "You white fellas came, you put the fences up and you just said it was yours." "And we are still living today," he said, Sammy Wilson said, with the consequences of the theft of those of our lands and all of the decisions you've made without consulting us." So it's a history that is unfolding still today. It is not past.
I mean, your book, though, is also the story of the historian at work as well, and what the historian finds and what the ethical obligations of that finding is. So you find in that garage a journal entry that says, "I fired to hit." So you discover, you solve this colonial crime. He intended to kill the Aboriginal person, firstly. Then there's the question that he kept the diary. The diary is kept. And so the tantalising question, did he want this information to be discovered later? Was this placating of his guilt? And then the point that you were graciously invited into that garage by his daughter, who you now have to tell the story about her. Tell us about how you dealt with that as a historian. So you complete a historical riddle, but in the same breath, you destroy in potentially the image of a father to a daughter.
Yes. it was very, very difficult. It was one of the most difficult things I've had to do as a historian. I mean, one of the things about writing history, of course, is that historians are usually working with documents that where they can place some distance between themselves and those documents. In this case, as soon as Bill McKinnon's daughter referred to her father as Dad and brought me into the family home, my whole relationship with this story shifted. Because it was no longer, I couldn't keep the distance. I was dealing with an entire family, all of whom had no previous knowledge of this shooting or the detail and its consequences and aftermath. So
I just got a question. How long did it take you to go through the journal to find that information?
Thanks, Fiona.
Was it days or weeks?
It actually required two visits because, you know, you can imagine the scene when I arrived in the garage and there's literally trunks of material, including every Marilyn Monroe film on reel-to-reel. And he was a compulsive collector of books about Central Australian history. He often annotated those books and crossed out lines where he thought the author was incorrect. He was a photographer. He had an incredible photographic collection of his time as a policeman in Papua New Guinea and in Central Australia. He collected Aboriginal art. So this was he was a compulsive record keeper. I think what I've tried to do in this book is an extension of my philosophy of history, I think, in writing history, and that is that as historians, I think we have to allow the reader to see how the strings, what we're doing. We have to be open, and we can't pretend that somehow this narrative is just being stitched together by some invisible person. Mm. We have to let the reader bring them in to all of the quandaries, all of the challenges we have as writers. And if they can see all of those things, then I think you're sharing your craft and the complexities of it with your readers. And that's what I try to do.
One of the things I got from reading your book, actually, that I really enjoyed was not only did the residues of what happened, not only do they play out today, but the silences play out today. So that history isn't just about that active interpretation isn't just about understanding what happened. It's also about not saying certain things. And I think that really comes through in your book, that this active curation is about listening, but also sometimes people aren't listening, or the historians aren't listening.
Yes, and that's one of the decisions that we all have, I think, as writers and historians, is how much do you spell out literally to your reader?
And how much has been told to you?
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
It's wonderful if you can leave the reader a space to find their own way into the story and make their own conclusions as well, without coming too far over the top and spelling out A, B, C, D, what everything is supposed to mean.
Yeah. I mean, one of the revelations from your book to me, Fiona, is not just the story of the Opium Act, but how it was basically a Trojan horse, the Opium Act, wasn't it? It appears to be an act to deal with the dangerous addiction to opium that is afflicting First Nations people, but actually it is used to enforce the establishment of all of these large reserves to which Indigenous people are forcibly removed as a form of protection. And once again, it's a story about a place that tells a bigger story about Australia.
That's right. So one of the architects behind the legislation, Archibald Meston, relocated 51 Butchler people from Maryborough across to the island. And there were two steps in that relocation. But the second step, they identify a place on Bagimba Creek. So it's called Bagimba Creek Mission. And they established the mission there under the state government. And at some point, he decides to bring more opium-affected Aboriginal people from across the state of Queensland, and that's the Trojan horse to get into communities and then act in a way where it's deemed okay to relocate men, women and children to different parts of the state. And also, Archibald Meston fell out of favour with the state government, and then they decided to hand the mission over to the Anglican Church through Ernest Gribble, who was running Yarrabah at the time, and that was in 1900. The mission was an abject failure on all fronts. Many people died while they were there from malnutrition, so there are still 70 shallow graves in existence there today. And they wound up the mission in 1904, took all the, I'll call them inmates, off that reserve. Some were relocated to Yarrabah on a ship. Some were sent to Cherbourg, and my family and other families were sent across to the mainland because we were gainfully employed either in the fishing or timber industry. And so it messed with a lot of people's lives. But the problem with a lot of the records is that they don't actually name individuals accurately in terms of who's there, and it's always a more generic terminology of language like blacks, natives and so on. So it's very hard to track some of the individuals that were kept at Bigimba Creek.
I'm familiar with your artwork, Black Opium, a work that you say, like much of your work, really addresses the collective amnesia about colonial Queensland and the treatment of First Nations people there. I wonder how you see that artwork as on its own contributing to a better understanding about the place and the period that you're talking about, and how just the presence of it and visiting that artwork, seeing that artwork, I think, in the State Library of Queensland, the impact that has on white fellas who see it.
Well, there are tours that are run to the sculpture often by an Indigenous company, Black Card run tours to the State Library, and also other sculptures by Indigenous people around the CBD of Brisbane. So I think, and people who go on those tours are mostly international tourists, so I think it has a huge impact on people. And every time I go up to level 4 of the State Library of Queensland, there are 7 reading rooms. They're always packed with people studying or intimate couples studying.
So another story.
You can never get into those rooms. But I think it's had a huge way of addressing visually, using a visual language to talk about that particular legislation, because otherwise it's very dry to look at a photocopied document.
Can we circle back to the notion of contested history? I was thinking when we came here today, I was thinking history is always contested, and a recent example of this was Bruce Pascoe's Dark Emu, a history that resonated with many people, myself included, but a history that was challenged by others and not necessarily challenged in the vicious way in which something, and Bruce's magnanimous response to that, that he started a conversation and he's happy for that conversation to proceed. It seemed to me that that was a very healthy departure from the kind of ugliness of the history wars discourse about right and wrong history. You want to comment on it, Anna?
Yeah, I was struck by Bruce's generosity in that regard, and I think it reflected his generosity as a historian more broadly, actually, in that he is allowing non-Indigenous people to feel connected to the humanity of this place beyond the colonial settler state. A lot of Australians feel deeply connected to this place, to its country, and might not have a language to inhabit or understand that connection. And I think that book gave people, non-Indigenous people, an entry point to feel connected to the places that they love in a meaningful way. And the way he has responded to the challenges to his work and the debate that has surrounded is an extension of that generosity, I think.
Mark, do you think we've passed peak history wars?
I think so. I think the climate now is moving, and the test will be the referendum that's coming and how that polarisation hopefully doesn't play out in that referendum. But I think with Bruce's work, you know, one of the big things about its success is Bruce. In other words, there's the book as a text, which has got this brilliant cover with an emu and dark emu, and what's this about? It's just an ingenious cover, I think, and the whole concept of the book. But it's Bruce's talent as a storyteller and his ability to communicate, which is a large part. It's a cultural phenomenon, the success of the book. It's a large part of its success. So that the success of Dark Emu isn't just in the text, it's in the storyteller and his ability to communicate with audiences.
And to convey the point that these colonial readings of Aboriginal culture and society have been quietly taken out of the sort of official national story, if you like, that historians at some point in the 19th century chose what should and should or shouldn't be in Australian history. Mm-hmm. And he shows that the history profession itself is part of this curation, if you like, of Australia's national memory.
I mean, we're talking about history as being a subject for discussion and debate and exchange and subjectivity and so on, but there are some people who still hold to the view that there is aspects of our historical story that shouldn't be challenged. Yeah. Alan Tudge, the former Federal Education Minister, last year said of the proposed changes to the National History Curriculum that they constituted a negative view of our history. He seemed unhappy that the significance of the Anzac legend should be open to different interpretations, which, I mean, there's many questions that flow from this. I mean, one is the persistence of Gallipoli as our national story is one, and why it has been so persistent, but also kind of secondly where it leaves the teaching and the telling of our history.
I mean, I think that political comment by the former federal government and by Tudge, it was speaking to an ever-diminishing percentage of the Australian population. I mean, I think that sense that Anzac is not contested, you know, that ship sailed a long time ago. And you even people, you know, when they returned from service were wondering how Anzac should be commemorated and how they felt as veterans. School teachers know that Anzac is contested, and the general public know that Australian history is contested. And I think in many ways, and maybe this actually goes back to some of Fiona's work and Mark's work as well, the community discussions around Australian history is still up for grabs, it's not fixed, it's open for interpretation, has been quite a long way ahead of where a lot of the political public discussion about Australian history has been.
Yeah.
We know that history is contested because, you know, our parents or grandparents can't agree about what happened. It's not that hard to see that Australia Day means different things to different people, and that the conversation of change the date, it doesn't have to burn a hole in our national or patriotic heart. It can be a constructive and important discussion to have, I think.
I mean, your book, Fiona, is correcting the historic record to some extent and presenting us with a history that's been hidden from us. More generally, what would your appraisal be about the presentation of our history today and whether it's more honest and more all-encompassing of the stories of those that have been excluded?
I think we're moving forward all the time, and what I'm encouraged by is Aboriginal people are being proactive in memorialising the frontier wars, and not far from here, you know, Ballina, Tabulum, Aboriginal people have created memorials with plaques on large boulders from a community-led acknowledgement that a massacre had taken place here. And I see the push for more Aboriginal memorials to be dotted around the nation. So I think Aboriginal artists are working in that space increasingly. Sometimes the work is exhibited in gallery spaces, and sometimes they're commissioned artworks outside, outdoors. And I think it's something that we will see more of in, not in competition, but in recognition of a different history that took place here.
Mm. Probably have to be a final question to you, Mark. You're writing an Australian history. We've just had this discussion about the changing nature of it, perhaps the perils of it. Mm. Tell us a bit about how you're approaching this big story.
What's out, Mark?
Where do I start? It certainly gives me headaches sometimes when I wake up in the morning and realise what I've taken on to write a short history of Australia. But
A short history of Australia.
In fact, the shortest, so not just short. 50 to 60,000 words approximately. That's short. So one of the things that I've realised, and this comes out of the conversation we've been having, is that so often short histories of Australia have been stories of national formation. How was the nation formed? Yeah, that's the expectation.
You have less than one word for every year.
That's a trick. So, very true. Very true. I think I should stop now then. But anyway, I'm throwing it in the bin, this idea, traditional idea of a history of national formation. I've realised I've got to take the nation out and put it back in a different way. And I'm not using chronology either, because chronology is a kind of prison, I think.
Yeah.
And then one event to the next. And it's been done to death, and it's boring. And so I have to find another way thematically of exploring, of opening up all of the incredible diversity of our country's history.
And that's where we'll have to leave that discussion at the Byron Writers Festival. I was talking with historian Anna Clark and Mark McKenna, and artist and historian Fiona Foley. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for listening. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.